there's, you know, many different trade groups that represent forestry or bioenergy interests that are deep pocketed, and they basically have lobbyists, you know, wearing out their shoe leather on a daily basis, prowling the halls of the UK Parliament and in Brussels, you know.
Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations, in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm today's host, Matilda Gettens, and you're listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Many states have now committed to renewable energy targets. The EU has committed to source at least 42.5% of its energy from renewable sources by 2030. Many activists and academics have rightly criticized this number as being too low. However, an issue that gains much less attention is which energy sources are actually being used and classed as renewable. Biomass and woody biomass in particular has been increasingly scrutinized over the last years, with over 500 scientists signing an open letter calling on EU and international leaders to stop burning trees for energies. What are the problems associated with woody biomass? How did we get into the situation we're in today? And what can we do about it? To discuss all these questions, it's my deepest pleasure to welcome Mary Booth to the show. Mary Booth is a founder and director of the Partnership for Policy Integrity, a small non-profit organization in the US working on forest biomass, energy and climate. She's worked hands-on in the field of woody biomass for over a decade now and is hence a great partner to discuss some of its issues and potential solutions. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely great to have you in the show. I'd like to take this conversation into three broad blocks. First, we'll talk briefly about issues in the use and accounting of biomass in theory. Second, we'll take the issue into real-world practice, looking at international supply chains, environmental injustices, and power interests. And lastly, we'll talk about some of the campaigns you and PFPI have worked on over the last years. And now, without further ado, let's get things started. Mary, why is burning woody biomass for energy not a sustainable solution?
I think that most people, when they think about climate change and how to address climate change, would not think that chopping down trees and burning them would be a good solution, right? Because trees take carbon out of the air and they're important for nature and forests. So burning them for energy seems about the worst thing you could do to generate renewable energy, especially given that burning wood for energy emits more CO2 than even burning coal. And yet this is exactly what is kind of the backbone of the European Union's renewable energy policy. More than half the renewable energy generated in the EU and the UK as well comes from burning wood for energy. So this is an absolutely insane approach to reducing emissions, something that actually increases emissions. And it's all covered up with this idea that somehow the biomass is sustainable, that certain precautions have been taken, when harvesting the biomass. But in fact, nothing is going to change the fact, just the basic physics, that burning wood for energy emits more CO2 than burning fossil fuels. And trees just don't grow back overnight. So this CO2 that's being pumped into the atmosphere is not being instantaneously offset. It's contributing to climate change.
Thank you so much for sharing that first insight on the biomass issue. Given what you're saying, that biomass even produces more energy than other forms of fossil fuels can, it seems surreal that it should be classed as renewable. However, as you alluded, there seem to be many loopholes and different regulations through which biomass is being accounted for as renewable. And I'd therefore love if you could tell us a bit more about these accounting loopholes associated with biomath, both those that are in the IPCC and within other policy frameworks?
So for lay people who don't follow this stuff, I'll just try and sort of give a simple overview. Most countries in the world report their greenhouse gas emissions under the UNFCCC, which is the UN's Framework Convention on Climate Change. And also the Paris Agreement requires countries to report their carbon emissions. And this is a great thing. We definitely want countries to say how much carbon they're emitting. But part of that reporting is also that countries talk about how much carbon is being taken out of the atmosphere by the land sector, which mostly means forests. When forests grow, they take CO2 out of the atmosphere and they convert it into biological carbon, i.e. trees. And so once it's been sequestered from the atmosphere, it's safely locked up out of the atmosphere. And in fact, increasing the amount of CO2 taken up from the atmosphere by forests is one of the things that climate scientists tell us we must do to address climate change. Now, when countries report their emissions and their sequestration, they do it by sector. And when you cut down trees and burn them in a power plant, that loss of carbon out of the forest is reflected in each country's land use account. So the carbon loss is counted in the land use part of the reporting, but when the CO2 is emitted out the smokestack of the power plant, or out the chimney of a home that's burning wood for fuel for heating, it's not counted because it's already been counted in the national level carbon accounting. So to avoid double counting, there's a convention of counting biomass emissions as zero in the energy sector. Now, this sounds crazy. We all understand that when you're accounting, if you're doing some kind of accounting, like for a business or whatever, if you've counted an expense in one place, you don't want to count it somewhere else. You don't want to double count. But just because you're counting it as zero in this other sector doesn't mean it's actually zero. There are emissions. They're counted in the land sector. But the convention of counting bioenergy emissions as zero in the energy sector has been seized upon and exploited by policymakers to pretend as if burning wood actually has zero emissions. I know that sounds incredibly stupid, and you just can't believe, as stupid as policymaking is, you just can't believe they would be that audacious. But in fact, that's actually what has happened. And basically, the biomass industry and the policymakers who support them are counting on this being just complicated enough that it's really hard for regular people to track it and understand what's going on. So if I sound like I'm oversimplifying, I assure you I am simplifying a little bit, but this is actually what's happening. They're allowed to count it as zero in the energy sector under UN rules, and they pretend as if it is actually zero. And so they offer millions, if not billions, of dollars, euros, pounds in renewable energy incentives to drive more and more and more burning wood for energy and counting that as renewable energy. And the pernicious effects of that are so wide ranging. I mean, obviously increasing CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, logging forests, degrading forests, cutting down the amount of carbon sequestration that forests can accomplish, not to mention air pollution, and hello, displacing solar and wind and geothermal and other kinds of renewable energy that really should be benefiting from all those billions in renewable energy subsidies that are instead being allocated to wood burning.
Thank you so much. It's really insightful to see what the accounting loopholes are and how policymakers' vested interests have managed to exploit them with really disastrous effects, both for the renewable energy cause and for all affected communities as well. I've got one last question in our more theoretical block now. There's a relatively new but growing concept, which is the idea of bioenergy and carbon capture and storage, also known under the acronym BECCS. I'd like to ask you if you could briefly explain what BECCS is, what your stance on it is, and what alternatives you would like to envision.
So BECCS is the combination of bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, which is a means of capturing CO2 that's coming out the smokestack, compressing it into a very concentrated form, and then pumping it below ground so that it can be stored in geological formations, allegedly indefinitely. Like, we'd better hope that it doesn't leak out, because that would be bad. The idea behind BECCS, so this is sort of had a proof of concept with coal, capturing coal emissions and pumping them below ground so that theoretically you then have a zero emissions coal plant. Of course, like with all such things, there's a million places where that doesn't quite turn out to be true. There's leakage of the CO2. There's lots of processes where that emit CO2 where it's not capturable, et cetera, et cetera. But theoretically, you can capture these emissions coming out the smokestack and pump them below ground. Now, if you do this with biomass, the idea is that you do it with biomass and then you regrow the biomass. And in regrowing the biomass, you take up more CO2 from the atmosphere. And then it's probably easiest to imagine this like with a fast growing crop like switchgrass or something that's being burned for energy. So that has a 1-year life cycle. So you burn the biomass, you concentrate the CO2, you pump it below ground. The next year, the grass grows back. It sequesters more carbon out of the atmosphere. You harvest that biomass, you burn it, you sequester it below ground, et cetera. Now, this all sounds great in theory. I mean, there's a million reasons why it wouldn't work even with a fast growing crop, because it just takes so many hectares of land to even generate a small amount of electricity, for one thing. And we kind of need land for other things like, hello, food. But with trees, the problem is it's the same problem as calling bioenergy without CCS carbon neutral. You're emitting a lot of carbon into the atmosphere when you burn trees, and trees don't grow back overnight. So that CO2 is not being offset in any way, shape, or form in any time frame that's meaningful to addressing climate change. Likewise, if you burn a tree and store the carbon below ground, you've just moved carbon that is in a non-atmospheric form, which is embodied in the tree, to another non-atmospheric reservoir, the below ground storage, but you have not accomplished any net removal of CO2 from the atmosphere. You have to wait for the tree to grow back for that to happen. Now, policies in the UK right now are being heavily promoted, also in the EU, billions of dollars being poured into this technology on the false premise that BECCS is going to deliver negative emissions. That is, it's going to instantaneously start removing CO2 from the atmosphere. Now, climate scientists tell us that we do need to remove CO2. It's not enough to just reduce emissions. To mitigate climate change, we have to actually reduce the concentration of CO2 that's in the atmosphere now. And the only way to do that is to develop something that sucks up a lot of carbon. Well, we don't actually need to develop it. It exists. It's called forests. And by renaturalizing forests and allowing forests to grow and increasing the carbon density in forests, we could suck a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere if we changed forest management to stop exploiting them so heavily. The answer is emphatically not to log them more intensively, burn that wood, and store the carbon below ground, because that is not going to deliver negative emissions. At best, it will reduce the amount of emissions going into the atmosphere from the smokestack, but it's not going to suck carbon out of the air. So this is a total false premise. It is obviously based on the idea that bioenergy is carbon neutral in the first place, which is fooled a lot of policymakers and they're wrong about that. But now they're just doubling down and compounding their error and spending even more public funding by combining one technology that doesn't work, bioenergy burning trees, with another technology that probably isn't going to work, CCS, as if that offers the answer. And it's simply, I keep talking about this as being a performance of climate policy making that's happening. There's a gigantic performance happening right now by a lot of policymakers who are desperate to look like they're doing something on climate. And so they're putting in place all these incentives for false solutions that are literally physically incapable of delivering negative emissions.
Thanks again. It's incredible to see how far that this erroneous assumption of burning biomass being carbon neutral has gone and what extremes that policymakers have taken it to and up to the idea of BECCS. And now that we've covered some of the theory, I'd love to look a little bit closer at the situation on the ground. As you're very involved also in campaigning, you know some things which maybe the more academic members of our audience are not entertaining on an everyday basis. I'd first like to ask you on the supply chain issue. So where does most of the woody biomass burn for energy come from and where does it go?
In Europe, most of the wood that's burned for energy comes from Europe. So Europe burns close to 400 million tons of biomass per year. Most of that is wood. A lot of that is, some of it's like crop residues and, you know, stuff, black liquor from paper mills and that kind of thing. But it's mostly just wood. And about half of that comes directly from forests, and about half is from sawmills and paper mills that have brought in wood as feedstock for their processes. And then there's stuff left over like sawdust and offcuts and stuff. So wood that's sourced directly from forests is called primary biomass, and wood that comes from other, secondary uses is secondary biomass. Some of this is turned into wood pellets. Some of it is burned as just logs in people's homes. Some of it is chipped and burned in power plants without being converted in pellets. A relatively small amount, but a growing amount of biomass is imported from non-European countries into Europe. And so overall, the wood pellet market, I don't remember the exact amount of wood pellets that are being produced total now, but it's still probably less than 15% of the total biomass burned in the EU. Some of it is being imported from the United States, Canada, and other countries, including even, for instance, Brazil. Shockingly, just amazing that they're putting wood chips and wood pellets into these gigantic boats and just boating it all over the world to end up in Europe and also Asia. Japan and Korea are also burning an increasing amount of biomass in power plants. But anyway, so the United States wood pellet market and also now increasingly the Canadian wood pellet manufacturing has received a lot of attention because these wood pellet companies are literally mowing down. I mean, they do use some sawdust and, offcuts and stuff from, secondary woody biomass to make pellets. But a lot of the wood comes from big old forests, including, for instance, in the United States, some of the most carbon rich and biodiverse forests in the whole country. These are forests that may not have been logged in 80 or 100 years, or maybe even ever. In Canada, there is unequivocal evidence. There's a fantastic expose done, a documentary by the BBC, showing that Drax, which is the biggest power plant in Europe, basically, it's in the UK, and they burn, the biggest biomass power plant, They burn wood pellets, and they also own wood pellet manufacturing companies themselves in the United States and in Canada. And this BBC documentary showed that Drax is harvesting, converting primary forest, forest that has never been logged since ever, it's primordial forest, cutting that down and turning it into wood pellets to be shipped back over to the UK and burned in a power plant. So you asked, where does it go? Well, there's a, you know, obviously a lively international shipping trade, and biomass is being traded all over Europe. There are certain countries that have been sort of big pellet producers, like Estonia and Latvia. I mean, they're in relative terms, it's a lot. It's in absolute terms, it's not a lot of pellets, but in relative terms, compared to their total wood output, it's a huge amount. So some of these countries are more involved in pellet production than others. Where it all ends up is the atmosphere. Pretty much guaranteed that wood that is cut for energy will be burned within a year. So it is pretty much the fastest way you can imagine to increase CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is to cut down forests and burn them.
Thanks so much for the insights on the complex supply chains and really seeing how wood and pellets are being shipped all the way from Canada, the US and Brazil over the large ocean to Europe, and also the trade within Europe with wood flowing from Estonia, from Latvia to other pellet burning countries. In general, I seem to notice a divide still partly though where wood is harvested and where pellets are being produced. And in general, there's been a strong association of environmental justice injustices occurring in the biomass sector. I wanted to ask you if you could tell me a bit more about those.
So there's been a lot of reporting, some great stories covered by pretty prominent outlets on the wood pellet industry in the southeastern United States. This is called the wood basket of the United States. It's historically the area that where just miles and miles and miles of natural forests have been converted into plantations, pine plantations. But also a lot of natural forests still exists. And a lot of these communities are very poor and minority dominated. And these wood pellet plants that have been built, and all of this really started, I mean, literally, it's very, very new industry. I mean, the first really big wood pellet plant in the United States only started operation in 2008. So pretty much the whole industry has expanded in the last 15 years. It's grown exponentially. But these, you know, these wood pellet companies, Enviva and Drax being the two biggest operating in the United States, tend to target areas that have a lot of wood and not a lot of, you know, people who are going to oppose them generally, because people are desperate for jobs and, you know, these are kind of poor areas anyway. And so there has definitely been, you know, a tight correlation of the socioeconomic status and a negative correlation between the socioeconomic status and the degree to which areas are minority dominated with their propensity to being colonized by these wood pellet companies. But, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. Just, I mean, the wood manufacturing industry in general is not exactly a clean industry. I mean, paper mills, paper industry, for instance, is also a really filthy industry that tends to find rural areas that with a lot of trees and not a lot of people.
Let's take this discussion in the same direction and talk about the big players in the international biomass system and what power they have. Who are these players in the international biomass system? So you've started talking a little bit about Drax, about Enviva. Could you give us a slightly bigger picture of who the main agents are that we should know and how they interrelate?
Certain companies have been extremely influential in helping form the EU's and the UK's biomass policy, and also trade groups. There's, you know, the Pellet Association, I think it's the International Pellet Association, and the in the United States is the National Association of Forest Owners, NAFO, that represent forestry or bioenergy interests that are deep pocketed, and they basically have lobbyists, you know, wearing out their shoe leather on a daily basis, you know, prowling the halls of the UK Parliament and and Brussels, you know. So we see evidence of this because sometimes when we like, for instance, we working with our colleagues at the Lifescape Project, which is a UK-based NGO that works on rewilding. But a few years ago, my organization, PFPI, partnered up with the Lifescape Project to form something we call the Forest Litigation Collaborative. And we're filing some science-based legal cases against governments and companies on forests and biomass, and kind of calling for more integrity of policy, basically. But one thing that you really notice, like we just filed a request to the courts in the UK for judicial review of the UK's recently published biomass strategy. And one thing that you notice when you get background documents, like you request documents from the government to review as part of the case, is how closely the talking points of the government track with exact talking points that are by DRACs in other places. We saw this in the European Union as well, that lobbyists from the biomass industry were essentially writing legislation and you know, sending amendments and markup. And this is totally par for the course. I mean, this is how industry works, right? They get in there, they get meetings. They're just ubiquitous. They're impossible to ignore. And they always have something, or they usually have something, a card to play that the environmental movement doesn't have, which is jobs, 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 jobs. And so they scare politicians into doing their bidding, basically, by saying, oh, but if you stop subsidies for DRACs or whatever, all these people are going to lose their jobs. And of course, you know, I mean, I'm getting off on a tangent here, but in that particular case, the UK has allocated and is preparing to allocate billions and billions of pounds as subsidies toward DRACs. And if they took some of that money and just invested it in creating new clean energy jobs for the people up there, like building solar panels, for instance, or something like that, then jobs thing could just go away. But anyway, long story short, I would say that these people are extremely influential, but they're also rather shadowy. And it's not always possible to know who exactly is behind the piece of legislation or thing that's being written. But you do see distinct similarities between government talking points and those of companies.
Now, let's get to our final block of your activism to counterweight these shadowy power interests. To get things started, could you tell us a little bit about why you decided to go into the field of woody biomass, and what made you decide to found PFPI?
I am an ecosystem scientist by training, and I had recently moved back to my home state of Massachusetts many years ago, and I found out about a wood-fired power plant that was being built nearby to me that had a proposal. I heard about this from a radio interview from this woman who was working to oppose this plant. And she was actually trying to oppose the water withdrawal permit for this plant, because the plant was going to take 800,000 gallons of water per day out of the Westfield River, which is a designated wild and scenic river in its upper reaches in Massachusetts. And they were going to suck 800,000 gallons per day of water out of this beautiful river to use as coolant for this biomass power plant. And basically 85% of that water gets blown off as steam out the cooling towers of the plant. and 15%, which is now boiled down and concentrated, like every single thing that's in the water is like boiled down and concentrated, and it's re-discharged into the river as warm contaminated soup, basically. She was fighting this water withdrawal permit, and I decided, based on her interview, because I had some time on my hands, that I would like to help her. And so I got involved in analyzing this water permit, but then very quickly realized that the main show was, why are they proposing to build wood burning power plants in the first place, when the physics shows that burning wood emits more CO2 than coal? And any 5-year-old can tell you that it's a really dumb idea to burn trees to mitigate climate change. So we did work on that wood, on that water withdrawal permit, and we did actually manage to improve it somewhat, but really we ended up killing that plant and other plants that were proposed in Massachusetts with a big campaign that involved a lot of people, not just us. They involved doctors and lawyers and scientists and regular people and tree huggers and even some foresters who just thought it was insane to propose these wood burning power plants that were going to more than double wood. They were going to require more wood than was already harvested in Massachusetts per year just to fuel these plants. It was bonkers. So I started, you know, basically working in Massachusetts to oppose those plants, and then started working more nationally in the United States, at the same time learning some expertise in reviewing air permits for emissions of conventional pollutants like particulate matter and nitrogen oxides, in addition to the carbon relations. And eventually started also working in the UK and the EU, because I realized that when it came to the wood pellet industry in the US Southeast and elsewhere, that it's hard to oppose an industry that makes a wood product that gets exported like we export so many other wood products. What needed to be done was to attack the demand. And it was the policies of the UK and the EU that were causing this demand. And so that kind of spurred us to start working internationally. And getting very fed up with activism, traditional activism and policy change, which is really slow and painful. And of course, you are always in opposition to the gigantic fleet of aforementioned biomass lobbyists wearing out their shoe leather. And so I decided to start, trying to collaborate with lawyers to, you know, resort to the courts, basically, when challenging some of these policies. You can't always challenge something legally just because you don't like it. You have to find a reason that it's actually contravening some law or policy or something. But it's not that hard to do, actually. There's so much lying and kind of crazy stuff going on in climate policy that really it's there are grounds to be had for filing litigation. So our work has more and more evolved to kind of a balance between litigation and just direct activism and policy advocacy that is always underpinned by rigorous science. So this has been the key to PFPI's work, is just really insisting that we be very transparent about the science and, you know, hold all of our work to a high standard in terms of trying to be transparent and explain, you know, to people who may not be scientists, what exactly the science is showing. That's kind of been the trajectory.
Thanks so much for sharing the origins and principles of PFPI. Could you tell me about one of your favorite campaigns in the past, or a campaign that you're currently working on?
I don't know if I'd call it my favorite, but certainly in terms of the ambition of what we attempted to do, the greatest by far, which was trying to get the Renewable Energy Directive in the EU to no longer include forest biomass as an eligible renewable fuel. So this was a basically 3.5 year long campaign that culminated last March 2023, the Renewable Energy Directive is the EU's piece of sort of umbrella legislation that tells all the member states what kinds of technologies are eligible to be counted toward the EU's renewable energy targets, which are compulsory, and also what kinds of technologies are eligible to get billions of euro in subsidies. And so we worked with many, many European NGOs and had a lot of assistance from another US-based group, the Natural Resources Defense Council, to campaign to get forest biomass taken out of the RED. And we weren't totally successful, but we did manage to get some new big restrictions on use of forest biomass as counting in terms of what member states can do to support it, including new restrictions on electricity power plants burning forest wood. So those restrictions haven't kicked in yet because, as is always the case with European level legislation, the legislation gets passed and approved at the EU level, and then it has to be implemented at each member state, and that takes a while. But I think we would have done a lot better in the campaign if the Ukraine invasion hadn't happened, and because the tenuous nature of, you know, the attempt to stop importing fuels from Russia, and you know, the reduced natural gas supplies and all that meant that policymakers were really in no mood to put restrictions on fuel burning of any kind. And of course, we weren't proposing to limit wood burning. What we were proposing was that wood burning should not be counted as renewable energy. But our opponents in the biomass and forest industries were very successful with policymakers in portraying the campaign as an attempt to actually reduce wood burning. I mean, of course, we do need to reduce wood burning. And a first step toward that would be to stop paying people to burn wood, right, as renewable energy, especially given it's making climate change worse. But basically, it would not have influenced in any way, shape, or form people's ability to burn wood. But they portrayed it as if it would, and the policymakers were very much in a burn everything kind of mood. And we still managed to get some restrictions on forest biomass use. So we thought that was a pretty good win.
Thank you very much for that positive note. We'll also take this optimistic tone to bring our show to an end. And to do this, I'm going to ask you the question we ask all our guests on the show. What is your rebellion?
My rebellion is just insisting on scientific integrity to underpin our policymaking. I mean, that doesn't seem like a rebellion, right? Seems so obvious that we want policies to be rooted in physical reality. But you'd be surprised how radical that has turned out to be in terms of pushing back on the idea that we should be burning trees for energy.
So many thanks to Mary Booth for joining us today, and thanks to you all for spending time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay tuned with us for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.